Very good. So, good morning. Shavua Tov to everyone from beautiful downtown Toronto. We are broadcasting Midtown Toronto. We're broadcasting from the luxurious broadcasting studios of the E-Team Broadcasting Network of Torah in Motion, which doubles as a concert hall in the background. We will begin our shiur in 1 minute.
Somebody has their speakers on and there's an echo. Rabbi Hale, are the speakers off in that room?
I'm broadcasting from Jay's office, so you'll have to ask him. Are your speakers on?
I don't know.
He doesn't know.
Well, either if he can hear you while you're hearing me, well, you've got the headphones on and speakers are on in the room.
Just hit that.
Okay. Now, is that better?
Much better.
Now I don't hear him at all. Hello?
Is that better? The speakers in the room, not the headset, need to be unplugged.
Hello?
We're hearing you. Plug your headset back in.
Okay, we're in good shape. Okay, I think it's time to begin. In our last shiur, a week ago, we studied the first Mishnah of the Perek, which gave us three cases to deal with. The first was one who says to his friend, Seva Kadesh Li Isha Plonit, V'halach V'kitcha Li Atzmo Mikudeshet Lashini, that he sends his friend to be Mekadesh a woman, and the friend, in not informing the woman of who sent him, is Mekadesh the woman for himself, and she is Mikudeshet to the friend, to the second individual. The second case is a case of delayed kiddushin delayed over 30 days, and the man who delays the kiddushin is leaving open a frame in time in which a second man may enter and be makadesh the woman who is considered to be single until the end of the 30-day period. And the third case is a case where we have a doubtful language on the part of the makadesh, where he says, Me'achshav u'le'achar shloshim yom. And we don't know whether his intention is to be Mekadesh her from today or to be Mekadesh in 30 days. These are the three cases of the Mishnah. And then, in last week's Shi'ur, we dealt with a series of three stories that appear in the Sugya about three Amoraim who had incidents in their life that were similar to what is discussed by the Mishnah. The first was Ravin Hasida, who went to be Mekadesh a woman for his son and ended up being Mekadesher for himself. The second was Rabba Barachana, who gave money to Rav and asked him to buy a certain piece of property, and Rav went and bought the property for himself. And the third case was a case of Rav Gidel, who was checking a piece of land, and Rabbi Abba went and bought the property out from under him. Not intentionally, but out from under him. And this case eventually came to Rabbi Yitzchak Napacha in Israel, and when Rabbi Abba came up on Aliyah, they discussed the issue, and they came to the decision that the land, he shouldn't have bought the land when Rav Gidel was checking it, and therefore he offered to have Rav Gidel receive it as a gift. Rav Gidel didn't want to receive it as a gift, and therefore the land remained unused because neither wanted to use the land that was in doubt. And we discussed the fact that these three cases are a kovetz. They are a preset series of stories that predate the sugya, and that their relationship here, the reason why this kovetz was filed in this sugya, on this Mishnah, is because of the similarity of the first case to our Mishnah, the case of Ravin Hasida. And that once the case of Ravin Hasida is here, it's the obligation of the editors of the Torah Amoraim to bring the entire set of three stories, and this causes the digression from the event relating to marriage to the two events relating to real estate. And that this is the Amoraic Sugya on this the first Sugya in this Mishnah. What we wanted to do during this lesson was to discuss how this Kovetz of Torah HaMoraim becomes embedded in a Stama Sugya, which has a purpose slightly other than the Kovetz itself. And I asked you all to take a look at this sugya and to try to come to an understanding of what exactly it is that the Stama is trying to do. What I'd like us to do is now go through the Stama, the sugya, together and see if we can uncover what exactly is going on. And this sugya serves as an excellent example of the relationship between Torah Tamoraim and the Shakla Vitaria in the sugya, in the sugyot of the Babylonian Gemara. The sugya begins that it's dealing with the first case. Ha'omer lechaviro tseva kadesh li shaplonit galach v'kichal le'acher mikudeshet lashini. And on this Mishnah, we have a braita. The Shakla Vitaria brings a little braita that says, Tana, ma she'asa asui, ela she'nahag bo min hagra ma'ut. And if you look in your Masoret HaShas in the Vilna Gemara, you'll see that this braita is from the Tosefta, from another Masechet entirely. It doesn't, it's not local to Masechet Kiddushin. It's dealing with another case. But the Gemara brings this braita here to our sugya and says that although the Mishnah tells us that she is mikudeshet to the second man, that the action is irrevocable, nevertheless, what the man did is considered reprehensible. It's ramaut. It's deception. And because after all, he was sent as a shaliach, and he's not fulfilled his shlichut, he's worked around it. So, ma she'asa asui, ela she'nahag bo minhag ramaut. And then the stem of the Gemara says, v'tana didan, and what about our Mishnah? What about the Tana of our Mishnah? Does our Mishnah also consider what the Chaver did by being Mekadesh the woman to himself to be Ramaut? And the Gemara answers, Halach name de katane halach bi Ramaut. That the language of our Mishnah, when it says at the beginning, in the first part of our Mishnah, Haomer lechavirot, seva kadesh li sha plonit, vehalach vikicha, it doesn't just say vikicha leatzmo, but halach vikicha leatzmo, that the word vehalach implies that the man went with deception as part of his intention. That he went with the intention of deceiving his friend who sent him. And therefore, halach beramaut. Now, the stem of the Gemara here is attempting, of course, to create an equation between the case of our Mishnah and the case of the Tosefta from which this braita is drawn. In order to build the premise of our sugya on the level of the Shakla Vitaria, that our Mishnah is talking about a case of deception, even though our Mishnah doesn't say that itself. Our Mishnah just tells us the halachic fact. It doesn't say that there's deception. But the Baal HaSugya, the one who is teaching this sugya, and that's the Shakla Vitaria, is attempting to set it up this way so that the Mishnah, our Mishnah, is also dealing with deception, no less than the Braita that is being brought here. And because we now have this premise that our Mishnah is dealing with Ramaut, we now have a very serious question about the Kovetz of the Amoraic sources that we studied last week. And that is, if our Stama de Talmudah, our Baal HaSugya, our Magid Shir, as it were, is telling us that our Mishnah is talking about Ramaut, and these three stories of the Amoraim are filed on this Mishnah, it would imply, God forbid, that these three Amoraim were also involved in Ramaut. How can that be? And therefore, our Magid Shir is building a web around these three stories of the Amoraim in order to teach us lessons about Ramaut. He's turning the Kovetz, the Amoraic Sugya, which is a Kovetz of three stories, into a Musar Shmus about Ramaut. And as we'll see how this develops as we go through the Sugya. But before the Baal HaSugya, before the Magid Shir gets to analyzing how Ramaut relates to the three cases of the Amoraim, he first has to take, there's an insertion of another piece of Stama de Gemara that compares our Mishnah to another Mishnah from the second Perek of Kiddushin, where the language is somewhat different. Here, we have the language Ha'omer Lechaviro. But in the second Perek, we have a case that says Ha'omer Leshlucho, a person who says to his agent, to his emissary, to go and be Makadesh a woman in a certain place, and he's Makadesh her in another place. What is the impact of the change in the fulfillment of the instruction to a place other than what was indicated by the Sholeach? And the Stamadig Gemara here wants to know why in our Mishnah does it use the terminology Ha'omer Lechaviro, where in the second parak it uses the terminology Ha'omer Lishlucho. And what the Gemara is going to come around to in line 2-bet is that in each case it's teaching us something that we would not learn from the other case. It's like Tzrichuta. As those of you that studied with me in the methods classes know that a Tzrichuta is a stumma formulation. It's a fixed argumentation pattern in stumma that appears hundreds of times in Shas, and basically takes two cases and demonstrate how each case is unique and teaches me something that the other case would not be able to teach me. And that's what we're doing here. In 2-bet, the Gemara says, Hacha ributa kamashmalan, vehatam ributa kamashmalan. That here it's teaching me a ributa, something more than what the other case did, and there it's also teaching me something more than the present case does. Now you could ask me, why is it that our Gemara uses the language of ributa and ributa rather than srihuta? And that's a good question. It could very well be that the different yeshivas in Bavel had different terminologies for the same literary phenomenon. We have other cases like that. We have cases, for instance, of Hanicha Laman versus Bishlam Laman, which are exactly the same purpose, but have two different formulations. There are other examples of this. And therefore, it could be that this is simply a different way of saying the same kind of idea. And the Gemara goes on to explain what is the ributa, what is the additional piece of information in each place. Hacha, and the Gemara says as follows, Hava mina shilucho hu dehavi ramai, desamcha da'ate, savar avi beishluchuti, aval chaviro dolo samcha da'ate, ema lo lihavi ramai. That in the case of a shaliach, where you appoint a person as an emissary, and he does not do what you've appointed him to do, I would think that that's the kind of a case where it's considered deception. But in our case, where it's a chaver, and he's just doing him a favor, then that's not really deception, because he didn't accept upon himself a formal emissarial kind of position. And then it says, "Ditana ha'omer lechaviro." That in the Mishnah in the second parak where it says Ha'omer l'shlucho, that I want you to be Makadish a woman for me in place A and he's Makadish in place B, that I would say that in that case, because the one who sends him assumes that the emissary is going to do whatever he has to do to fulfill his mission, that she would be mikudeshet in any event, despite the fact that he fulfills the mission in another place than that which was indicated. But a chaver, which we have here, that he's only doing a favor, he's not going to trouble more than a certain amount, and therefore I would say that in his case it would be in amikudeshet. But in the case of a shaliach, it would be kamashmana. So what the Gemara is doing is teaching a tzrichuta on the languages haomer l'chaviro and omer l'shlucho. But implied and standing behind this tzrichuta, this ributa kamashmalan, is the assumption of ramaut, that what we are dealing with here is a case of deception, and that what the emissary does, whether he's a shaliach or whether he's a chaver, that in both cases, really, what he does is considered deceitful. And this brings us now to the analysis of by the Magid Shir of the three cases of the Amoraim that are brought in the Kovetz. And you have to remember what the context is here. This shiur, this Magid Shir, is giving this shiur in front of a group of highly educated Talmidei Chachamim who know these sources perfectly. They know the Mishnah, they know the Braita from the Tosefta and the other Masechet, they know the three cases of the Amoraim, and they're coming to the Magid Shir to give them value added. And he's giving them a chakira in Ramaut. What is Ramaut and what is not Ramaut based on this Mishnah? It's as if he is overlaying his shiur about Ramaut on top of the earlier sources. He's using the early sources as a framework to teach his shiur on Ramaut. In Hebrew terminology, we call this sugya mulbeshet. That is one sugya that is overlaid on top of the other. The original sugya is the kovetz of the three stories of the Amoraim, and the overlaid stama sugya is the chakira of the Magid Shir about Ramaut. Now what does he do? After the story about Rabin Chasida, the Magid Shir says, and now you recall this Braita that we just quoted on our Mishnah, Mashe Asa Asui She'ele Shenahagbo Minhag Rama'ut, and therefore can we make an assumption from here that Rabin Chasida acted V'Rama'ut Chas V'Shalom? How could such a thing be? And therefore we end up with a discussion of how he could have done it. And therefore the Gemara starts, Lo Yahavuha Nihale. The reason why Rabin Chasida was Makadesh the woman for himself rather than for his son. He tried to be Makadesh the woman for his son. That was his intention. That was his attempt. But the people in the place refused to give this woman for his son. They thought his son was not Maspik Mechubad. Wasn't it enough? Wasn't on a high enough level for her. And therefore, he had no, if he wanted to save the woman for his family, to take his woman to his family, he had no alternative but to be Makadesh her for himself. So then the Gemara says, well, if that's what you want to claim, he should have let him know. He should have gone back to his son and said, look, they don't want to give her to you, and I therefore, with your permission, I'm going to take her for myself so that we'll at least have her for our family because she's a wonderful woman. Why didn't he do that? And the Gemara answers in 4 Dalet, Savar ad hachi v'hachi ata ini shachrina mikadeshla. Because he said by the time he goes back to his son to let his son know what's going on, and then he gets back to the place where the woman is, someone else is going to be Makadesh this woman, and she'll be lost to his family. There was no time to accomplish this courtesy with his son. And therefore, he was simply Makadesh her on the spot. Now, I don't know how you feel about this conversation in the Stamma de Gemara, but I think it's safe to say that the conversation is a little bit forced, because it's an attempt to explain Rabin Chasida's behavior in the context of the Sugya on Rama'ut. And therefore, the Stamma de Gemara is creating a set of circumstances that could have taken place around the shlichut of Rabin Chasida that could possibly explain his behavior. Not because the Bala Sugya knows that this is exactly what happened, but rather this is what he is assuming happened, because it's unthinkable that Rabin Chasida would have behaved by Rama'ut, and therefore there must have been extenuating circumstances. Now, Eitan Diamond in Toronto is asking as follows. Pardon for interrupting, but if this is an overlay that is a different interpretation from the original Mishnah, why is this in Kiddushin? Why not in some other part of the Talmud that deals with other transactions and Rama'ut? And the answer, Eitan, would be as follows. Remember that the Kovetz of the three stories of the Amoraim was filed here because of the virtual identity of the case of Rabin Chasida with the case in our Mishnah. That's fixed. The Torat Amoraim is here. It can't be moved. It's been filed. It's been fixed. So when the Bala Sugya comes to relate to this Sugya, he's relating to material that they can't change it. It's here. He wouldn't want to change it. It's part of the Masorah. So what does he do? He attempts to overlay onto it a shiur that would be effective given the Amoraic material that's already in place. And it's actually the wonderful shiur that he's giving on Rama'ut. It works. But and you could say, why doesn't he teach similar lessons in other places in Shas where other things might be relevant as well? And it could be that we'll find similar sugyot, but it's not a kasha on why the sugya is here. It's here because it's based on the Amoraic material that was already filed on this spot. Now let's move on. On the second case of Rabba Bar Barchana that gave money to Rav and asked him to buy a certain piece of land, the Gemara basically goes through exactly the same pattern. It says, Mashe Asa Asui Elisha Nahagbo Minhag Rama'ut. It quotes the same bright again, saying that is it possible that Rav could have behaved by Rama'ut? And the Gemara explains, Be'aga de'alime havale, le'rav nage be'kavod, le'rabba babarchana lo nage be'kavod. That this land that Rabba Babarchana wanted Rav to purchase for him was in a location of people where the population was very violent, very aggressive. And they had kavod for Rav. They were prepared that Rav would buy a piece of land among them. They were not prepared to allow Rabba Bar Barchana to become the owner of a piece of land in their community. They had no kavod for him. And therefore, Rav said, okay, I see it's a nice piece of land, and they're not going to give it to him anyway, so I'll buy it for myself. In the same way that we saw in the first case with Rav and Chasida, the people were not prepared to give the woman to Rav and Chasida's son, and therefore he said, okay, I'll take the woman for myself. So the Gemara asks in 6 Gimel, he should have let Rabba Bar Bachana know that he cannot accomplish his mission, and therefore that he is taking the land for himself. And the Gemara answers the same answer that it answered by the woman, Savar ad hachi v'hachi ata inish achrina zavin la. That he thought that the land would be sold to someone else in the meantime, and therefore he decided that he was going to buy it for himself. And therefore we end up with the same solution to the problem that we had in the case of the woman. When we get to the third case in the series, the story about Rav Gidl, you can see that there's no stam of the Gemara on it at all. There's no stam of the Gemara. And the reason there's no stam of the Gemara on the third story is because the story itself explains the motivations of the Amoraim involved, that Rabbi Abba really didn't think that Rav Gidl wanted it. If he would have known, he wouldn't have done this. And so here you see, coming to fulfillment in the third story, the values, the pristine and beautiful values of Chazal that needed to be filled in for the stories of Rav and Chasida and Rabba Bar Bachana, because the stories were too terse to say teach these messages. But the third story requires no commentary, and therefore we have it at the end of the sugya without any stama augmentation. Now, Binyamin Weiss from Thornhill is asking, why couldn't we say he took it with the intention of selling it to Rabba Bar Bachana? In other words, why didn't the Gemara say that? Well, I think, Binyamin, because the people of the place, it was not that they didn't want to go through the act of sale to Rabba Bar Bachana. They were unprepared to have Rabba Bar Bachana own a piece of property among them. So if Rav would have bought it and sold it to Rabba Bar Bachana, the people would have reacted in a violent way. And therefore, that was not an option. That, presumably, is what the Gemara would say to your question. Now, I want to point out several points of method that come out of this sugya. Number one, are we sure that what the Magid Shir is saying in the Shat Vataria is the pshat of the first two cases of the Amorei Kovetz? What is your impression? Can we be sure that this is exactly these were the circumstances surrounding Rav and Chasida and Rabba Bar Bachana? What do you say? Yes or no? Please speak, people. Is it speculation, or is it? Or are we sure? Eitan says it's speculation. Are there any other opinions? And Binyamin Weiss says, can't be sure. Why are the only people speaking from Thornhill? We can hear other people too. But I would say that you're both right. We can't be sure, and the fact that we can't be sure means it's a speculation. And because of that, what we're coming across here is that it's a good educated guess on the part of the stoma. And so I think what we can come around to is the fact that what is the stoma of Gemara trying to do? What is it trying to add to the terse Torah of the Amoraim? It's attempting to fill it out, to give it more flesh, so that we can see what was the circumstances surrounding what was said. But also sometimes the stoma of Gemara is presenting a chakira, an investigation, which is not primarily concerned with the pshat of the sources of the Amoraim. It's using the Amoraim as a base to teach something additional that was not included in the Torah Amoraim. This is why it is so important when you learn Gemara to separate the layer of Torah Amoraim from the layer of the Shakta Vitaria, because they are not necessarily broadcasting on the same network. The Amoraim may be saying X, and the Stam of the Gemara will use it to say why. That's perfectly legitimate, because in their day, everybody knew what they were doing. The Stam of the Gemara was not pulling the wool over anybody's eyes. Everyone who was listening to the Shi'ur knew very well what the Stam of the Gemara, what the Bala Shi'ur was doing. because they knew the Amorek sources just as he did. It was the enjoyment of hearing a chakira from the Rosh Yeshiva. The same way that when I sat in Rav Soloveitchik's shir of blessed memory, you see that he was using the sugya as a basis for a conceptual chakira that he wanted to teach us. It wasn't always the pshat of the sugya. It doesn't have to be the pshat of the sugya, because you already know the sugya of the and therefore you're interested in value added. Now, Eitan asks that, he says, I assume, are there examples where the same Amorek source is used in very different stama explanations in different sugyot? Yes, there are such cases where you can find that the same source will be understood by the stama of the Gemara differently in two different places. And that's perfectly okay. There's nothing surprising about it. Now, that's number one. Number two, another point I want to make. You know that in my methods classes, I've taught you that the Amorek sources are virtually always in Hebrew, 85% of the time, whereas the Stama de Gemara is 100% of the time in Aramaic, except for quotations of earlier material. But if you look in our sugya, you see that all three stories that make up the kovetz of the Amoraim in the sugya, they're all in Aramaic. Why are they in Aramaic? They shouldn't they be in Hebrew? They are Amorek Torah. And the answer to this is because, one, I said 85% of Torah HaMoraim is in Hebrew. 15% is in Aramaic. One of the categories of Aramaic language, Torah HaMoraim, is halachic stories. Now, Tobias Roth in Miami is asking, why can't we say that the Amoraim are coming to explain the conditions under which the Rama'ud is permitted? Well, I doubt that Amoraim would permit Rama'ud under any circumstances, Mr. Roth. Rama'ud is something that is so negative and so anti-Jewish values that there's no way that an Amora is going to say it's permitted to be a Ramai. It's permitted to be deceitful and deceptive and tricky. No way that they would be trying to say that. And therefore, the stoma bends over backwards to find circumstances that would explain the actions of the Amoraim without any resort to something that even smells of Rama'ut. Now, Eitan Diamond is saying, they are stories about them, not statements by them. That's right. These are stories about the Amoraim, not statements of the Amoraim, and therefore, Aramaic is perfectly normal. Aramaic is also used in Torah HaMoraim in several other contexts. For instance, in dialogue. Amoraic dialogues are kept in Aramaic. Also, as we see here, stories. Also, Agadata is kept in Aramaic by the Amoraim. A fourth example would be the giving of a psak din by an Amora in the presence of Amei Haaretz that only speak Aramaic. And there are certain exceptions additionally, but those are the main categories. It covers 99% of all the cases of Aramaic Torah Amoraim. Teddy Sher in Brooklyn is asking, were there other suggestions for the reasons of the Amoraim? No, not that we have. You have to remember that the Gemara that we have in front of us is, although it's massive, is only a partial record of what the Amoraim said and did. Because we're dealing here with 1,438 Amoraim over a period of 300 years, and it's clear that the 2,700 double pages of the Bavli cannot contain within them the sum total of the lives of 1,438 people over 300 years. But what we have in the Gemara is a representative sampling of what was collected from the Torah HaMoraim and edited onto the Mishnayot that we have. And therefore, when you say, were there other suggestions for reasons of the Amoraim, it could very well be that there would be other suggestions, or that the circumstances of the cases might have been different. But what we have is what their work is. What we have, that's all we have. We don't have more. Maybe out of excavations in Iraq, we'll come up with more data about the yeshivot in Bavel, and then we'll be able to go further. But right now, this is what we got. Are there any further questions on the first sugya before we go on? Either through the chat room or by speaking. Okay, I don't hear any comments. I don't see any typed messages. So we will proceed. Take a look at the second sugya now. V'chein ha'omer la'isha, hitkashili le'achar shloshim yom. A man says to a woman, you're married to me after 30 days. And that means that right now he gives her money, the kesef kiddushin. And in 30 days he comes back and he says, okay, now the kiddushin is effective, now you're mikudeshet. So the Gemara asks a question. The Mishnah tells us that if a second man intervenes during these 30 days and is mekadesh her, that she's mekudeshet to the second man. What happens if no man comes in the middle? Lo ba acher v'kicha b'toch shloshim yom mahu. What happens if no man comes? So you're going to say to me, well, what's the question? What's the problem? It's clean. There's a 30-day delay reaction on the kiddushin. And if there's no interruption in the middle, why would I have the slightest assumption that there would be a problem? So, and especially when Rav and Shmuel are both brought by the Gemara that says to say on both of them together, mikudeshet, that the woman is definitely mikudeshet after 30 days, the afal pi shenit aklu hama'ot. Here we discover what concerned Rabotenu ha'amoraim. They say the woman is mikudeshet even though the money has been used up over the 30 days. Now, what does this mean? It means that there was an assumption on the part of the Gemara that even though you have a delayed reaction kiddushin, that at the moment when the kiddushin become effective, you have to have kesef kiddushin at that time. Or else the woman is not mikudeshet because she is not connecting the effective point of the kiddushin with value added to her. The money she had, but it's gone. And now, at the moment when she's actually becoming mikudeshet to him, her expectation is that there's going to be some transfer of capital on account to everything that the husband is going to be obligated to provide for her in the future. And if that isn't there, you might think that there's some kind of a pogam, of a fault in the kiddushin. Rav and Shmuel come to say, no, even if the money is used up, that does not necessarily provide any question, from the point of view of the expectations of the woman or of the halacha about this case. She received what was coming to her, and there can be no expectation for further payment at the time of the kiddushin. Now, the stem of the Gemara wants to know why. What's going on here from a legal point of view that means that the woman is not required to receive any additional money at the actual moment of the kiddushin? So the Gemara says, "My Tama, what is the reason that she is mikudeshet even though the money is gone? Hane zuze la lemilvadamo velo lepikadondamo." Because the money that he gave her 30 days ago, when he proposed in the first place, is not considered similar to a loan, and it's not considered similar to a trust that he's entrusted into her. And the pikadon lo damu, it's not similar to a trust, because pikadon birushuta demara kamit achle, because vahane birushuta dida kamit achla, because if it was a pikadon, when you give a trust to someone, there's no change of ownership over the entrusted article. The entrusted article remains the property of the one who entrusted it. And if it's for some reason it's used up, if someone entrusts, let's say, fruit, and the fruit decays and is gone, then the loss takes place within the ownership context of the one who entrusted it. The fruit would never have been transferred to the one guarding it. But in our case, when the man gave her the money and said to her, in 30 days you're going to be mikudeshet to me, his intention was to transfer ownership over that money to the woman. And therefore, it's not similar to a trust. Lamilve namilodamu, says the Gemara, they're also not similar to a loan. Why are they not similar to a loan? Because, says the Gemara, milve lohotza'anitna, vehane b'torat kiddushin yahavinhu nihala. Because when you give a person a loan, You're giving the loan to the person, and the person decides what he's going to do with that money, for what expense he's going to use it. There is no control over by the giver of the money over the use of the funds by the one who's receiving the loan. But in this case, the funds have been earmarked. When the man gave her the money and transferred ownership of the money to her, he did so earmarking his money to serve as kiddushin for her, not for any other general expense. It wasn't for a remake of her home, and it wasn't to buy a boat, and it wasn't for any other purpose. It was for the purpose of kiddushin, and therefore it's not similar to a case of a loan. Now, what we come up with, therefore, says in what the Gemara is explaining to us, is that according to Rav and Shmuel, a delayed action kiddushin is no less viable and no less effective than an immediate kiddushin. It's as if there's suspended animation. With one exception, if there is an interruption of the process. Because since the money was given for kiddushin, which has not happened for another 30 days, the woman is effectively still single, and therefore, if we have interruption of the process, either by another man, or by some other change that we're going to see in the next sugya, then it could interrupt the process of the 30 days. Otherwise, the process continues to its fruition, and the money that was originally given, which was given for kiddushin, is effective to create the bond between the man and the woman. And now, in this case, let me ask you, what language is the Maimra in? What language is the Maimra in? So, Avi Kidron from Detroit says Aramit. Avi, look again. The Maimra says, Mikudeshet af al pi shenit aklu hama'ot. That's what Rav and Shmuel said. Mikudeshet ve'af al pi shenit aklu hama'ot. That's in Hebrew. What is in Aramaic, Avi? The part that comes after that. My ta'ama, etc. That's in Aramaic. That is already shaklavataria. Those are not the words of the Amoraim. And this is what we call Perush HaMemra, explanation of the Memra. And the explanation of the Memra as part of the Stamma de Gemara, the Shaklavataria, is in the normal Aramaic language. Here you have a classic example of how you can distinguish the Memra from the Shaklavataria by language. That the Memra is in Hebrew, the Shaklavataria is in Aramaic. The other distinguishing characteristic of the Memra, of course, is that it's brought with the name of the Amora who says it. Rav Ushmuel. Rav and Shmuel say this. And therefore, we know that it's a Memra because it's attached to a given personality. These are the two identifying characteristics of a Memra, name, and usually in Hebrew, except for the exceptions that I described earlier in the lesson. Okay, let's move on. That was a very brief sugya, but it sets the tone for the next sugya, which is a longer sugya, a more involved sugya. But it's based on the same on the principle we developed in the second sugya, that delayed kiddushin works as long as there's no interruption in the process to disturb the kiddushin. And so now, in number three, we have an interesting case. Lo ba acher v'kicha, no other man interrupts the process of the 30 days, v'chazraba. But who interrupts it? The woman. The woman herself says, hold on. During these 30 days, she wakes up one morning and says, this is not my knight in shining armor. I'm not interested in this guy anymore. What happens then? Is she able to get out of the kiddushin because they haven't been effective yet? Or is she bound by her acceptance of the money at the beginning of the 30 days? And here we have a machloket between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Chozeret, Reish Lakish Amar Eina Chozeret. And if you'll note, on each one of these two short memrot, you have an Aramaic gloss. Let's take a look at it. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Chozeret, Ati Dibur Umivatel Dibur. What language is the gloss in? What is the language of this glass? Aramaic. That's correct. Aramaic. Well done. Both Jeff Kupferman and Teddy Scher wrote it immediately, that it's Aramaic. And this is different than the Mamre itself. The Mamre of the Amora is Choseret. The woman can go back on herself and get out of the Kiddushin. The Gemara in Perusha Mamre explains what the Amora said, Choseret, with the phrase, Ati Dibur Umivatel Dibur. In the same way, Reish Lakish says, Eina Choseret, and then the Gemara in Perusha Memra says, Lo Ati Dibur Umivatel Dibur. Now, before we go any further, let's analyze this. This is a very, very important thing. What is the difference in function between the Memra and the Perusha Memra? What is the difference in function? What is the that's right, Jeff, correct. The Memra is the halacha. That's right. And Avi Kidron says it did not understand the question. Okay, Avi, take a look again at the sentence. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Choseret Ati Dibur Umevetel Dibur. Ha'amora Amar Rakat Amila Choseret. Same de Gemara Amar Perusha Mimra Ati Dibur Umevetel Dibur. Vani Shoel Ma Hayevdel Bafunktia Betafkid Bein Hamilim Mila Shala Amora Leven Hamilim Shala Same de Gemara. And the difference is that the Rabbi Yochanan is giving us a psak halacha, choseret. The stama is giving you the svara of the psak halacha. He's giving you the conceptualization, the abstraction of the psak halacha. Psak halacha of the Amora is always concrete. Ken, lo, mutar, asur, choseret, eina choseret, in the specific case that we're referring to. That's called hora'a. It's a clear-cut psak halacha, but the stama de Gemara wants to go a step further. It wants to take this point, concrete halacha, and transpose it into an abstract conceptualization that can be applied in other circumstances. We can now say, for instance, in other cases that come up that involve a dibur and dibur, where we want one speech to cancel another speech, we can say, well, Rabbi Yochanan seems to have held, in that case in Kiddushin, that dibur can cancel dibur. And if he held it there, he would hold it here. And therefore what's happening is we are raising the statement of the Amora from a concrete, limited psak halacha to a conceptualization that may be applicable now in 100 other places. Now, let me ask you this. On what basis does the Stama de Gemara attribute this svara to Rabbi Yochanan? Does the Stama de Gemara know that Rabbi Yochanan held Ati Dibur Umevetel Dibur, that one speech can come and cancel the other? Or is the Gemara suggesting that Rabbi Yochanan could hold this? Or is the Gemara surmising that Rabbi Yochanan might hold this? What exactly is happening here? What would you say? Stanley, could you please press down the button before you speak so we can hear you?
Yes, okay. I would imagine that it's a matter of speculation, that it's not a Masorah that they're passing on. The Masorah is the words of Rabbi Yochanan, and now they, generations later, are speculating as to what concept lies behind the psak halacha.
Yes, you are 100% correct. Now, how can we prove that this is speculation, that it's a suggestion, and it's not based on a Masorah about Rabbi Yochanan held? From a methodological point of view, how, ladies and gentlemen, would you suggest that we could prove such a thing? How could we prove such a thing?
If it was part of the Masorah, might it have been attached to the words, the very words of Rabbi Yochanan?
In what language would they be? and they would be in Hebrew. Number one. Number two, we have many, many places in the Gemara where the Samed Gemara will propose a Svara to explain an Amora, and then the Samed Gemara itself will prove that the Svara is not correct, and that we have to suggest a different Svara. This tells us that they're speculating, and they're attempting to match a Svara to the Amora. Okay? The in addition, we can also check whether there are other places where the Amora in question says something other than what the Stam of the Gemara is suggesting. In our case, because the Amora is from Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yochanan is from Tveria in the second generation, we can check in the Yerushalmi, and we can see if by chance Rabbi Yochanan's Svara is brought in the Yerushalmi, and we can see if the Svara brought in the Yerushalmi is like the Svara brought in the Bavli or not. In this specific case, we are fortunate enough to have a parallel Sugya in Yerushalmi, and we can see that this is not the Svara that Rabbi Yochanan had originally. This is not the original Svara. The Stam of the Gemara is suggesting the Svara for a specific reason, which we will uncover as we go through the Sugya. The Stama is not even suggesting, I would say, that Rabbi Yochanan must have held this. The Stam of the Gemara is creating a hypothetical construct for its own reason, and we'll discover that within the next lesson or two. Now, Eitan is asking, how then does one particular explanation become the accepted fact? It doesn't. It doesn't become the accepted fact. What happens in a sugya, once the Stam of the Gemara is satisfied that a certain Svara could well match an Amora, then the sugya will end. But it doesn't transpose the suggested Svara into a statement that this is definitely what Rabbi Yochanan held. We're happy with this. It works. It works within our system of conceptualization and abstraction. It works, and therefore we're happy with it. And that's all. Now, later on, in the days of the Gaonim, and in the days of the Rishonim, then it could lead to a psak on the part of the Rishonim, as Eitan is suggesting now in his last statement that he typed here. It could lead to a psak that the Rishonim could say, the fact that the Gemara was happy with this and did not see any need to alter it in any way means that we can buy it from a conceptual point of view and use it as a basis of psak. And this is the normal process of psak halacha from the Gemara to the Rishonim, because even though the Stam of the Gemara is not hora'ah, it doesn't have this classification of psak halacha with the strength of the Sanhedrin, it has the strength of psak halacha by virtue of its being accepted by Klal Yisrael as part of the Mesorah of the Gemara. It has the same force of chiyuv, but it has a different source of authority. The Amoraim work with the authority of the Sanhedrin in back of them, even if they're in Bavel, because they said, Anan shlichutayu kovdinan, we're doing their shlichut, and therefore we have the force of the Sanhedrin from Eretz Yisrael. But after the Sanhedrin is closed and the Amoraic period comes to an end, there is no shlichut of Sanhedrin anymore, because Sanhedrin is gone. But the conceptualization and the abstraction that constitutes the Stam of the Gemara, that it becomes accepted by sheer force of the acceptance of Am Yisrael of the Stam of the Gemara as part of the Talmudic tradition, and it becomes the basis of the work of the next generations. Now you're going to ask me, how can the sheer acceptance by the people of the Stam of the Gemara have the same force as the legally binding nature of the Sanhedrin itself? The Sanhedrin, after all, is a duly invested body and has the right to give psak halacha for the nation. How can just the fact that people popularly accepted the Stam of the Gemara as part of a text give it the same value as the Sanhedrin? And I'll give you an answer directly out of Torah HaRav Kook. Where does the Sanhedrin get its authority from? Where does Sanhedrin get its authority from? The sanctity of the Sanhedrin comes from Am Yisrael. It comes from the people. And therefore, although the Sanhedrin is empowered by the people to do what it has to do, when there is no Sanhedrin, power to the people. The power goes back to the people. It reverts to its source. And the people, by acceptance of the Stamidig Morah as part of the Talmudic tradition, are thereby granting it Kiddusha and a level of obligation that binds us and binds Klal Yisrael. And on that basis, the Gaonim and the Rishonim proceed. So you'll say to me, now, if that's the case, Pinchas, then why do we have to separate between the Amoraim and the Samadi Gemara? If they both have the same level of authority, what's the point of the separation? Why do we have to go through all of this layer separation? And the answer to that question is, because our point in studying Gemara, Avi Kidron is asking, as lema'aseh is the psak halacha lechol devar. And yes, as a matter of fact, lema'aseh, the Stamma di Gemara is psak halacha. It becomes psak halacha lechol devar. That's correct, Avi. You're right about that. So why do we have to divide between that and the Amoraim? Does anyone like to suggest an answer to that question? Would anyone like to suggest an answer to that? Well, the suggestion I would make to you is as follows. And this is something I say to all the teachers that I train all over the world. The Mishnah and the Gemara are not products only. They are processes. We're interested in learning process, not only learning product. And Eliyahu Gerstel is saying, how about simply the way legal systems operate? Convention, i.e. a function of all legal systems as a human function. Thus, once you set up a system, then convention is a corollary of having such a system. Yes, I believe that. Yes, I think that's correct. That's a good way to say it. But I want to suggest to you that what we're after in learning Mishnah and Gemara is to learn the thought process of the Amoraim. We want to know how did they think. And the only way we know how they think is to follow the development of the halakha from one generation to the next, so we can see what every layer is adding on top of the previous layer. And the Stamma di Gemara more than any other layer, because the eight generations of the Amoraim all deal with psak halakha. The Stamma di Gemara in its origin was dealing more with Perusha Memra, with conceptualization and abstraction. It was a quantum leap into the cyberspace of unconditional halakha. And as such, is a very important stage for us to understand how the halakha developed afterwards. So even though our study, our separation of layers, may not have any implications halakhically, and usually it does not have implications halakhically, because the halakha is established based on the Rishonim and the Shulchan Aruch, not on the basis only of the sugya, nevertheless, within the learning of the sugya, if you're going to learn Gemara already, learn it right. Learn it with all of the flavor and the stages in development that it has. If you're interested in learning halacha, don't pick up a Gemara. Pick up a Rambam. Pick up a Shulchan Aruch. You don't need the Gemara for that. But if you're learning Gemara, you're learning process that lies behind the halachic product. And that process can only be understood by layer separation. And Eitan says, but can't we also assume that the Amoraim held their own shiurim where they expounded conceptual ideas? Did they really sit around and only issue piskei halacha? Very good. Excellent question. And the answer is, of course, that's what they did. But we have to remember that the Amoraim were akin to the Tanaim in terms of their purpose. They operated with the force of Sanhedrin. Their students, when they preserved their Torah from these probably brilliant shiurim that the Amoraim gave, their students summarized the lessons in a terse Hebrew language statement carrying the name of the Amora. Why did they do it that way? Because they wanted to say and recite these memrot by heart as part of the halachic Masorah. What that meant was that much of the expansive discussion of the Amoraim in their yeshivas was not preserved. It wasn't preserved. All we had from them is the Amoraim. So it's as if, what did the Amoraim do? They dehydrated the shiurim and left us only the dehydrated food so they could pass it on, so that the Stamma di Gemara at a later date could add the water back in. And so we're going through this process, and Eitan, you and I discussed this over supper on Friday night, that that what we have here is a three-stage process. We have the development of halakha by the Amoraim in their yeshivot. Second of all, we have the compilation of Memrot, which are the distilled piskei halakha from these brilliant shiurim of the Amoraim, passed down as Masorah, without the Svarot, in most cases. And then comes the Stamed Gemara, and reestablishes the Svara that has been, puts the water back in, as it were, in order to flesh it out again. Now, Peter Beauregard from Berkeley is saying, in a way, it's like learning dance or some other movement. You learn first by following the physical patterns, and here we're following the conceptual patterns. A real gadol is one who can fill in the blanks because they have thoroughly internalized it. I couldn't agree more. That's exactly right, Peter. The gidolim are those who have so internalized the statements of the Amoraim and the values that they express that they're able to conceptualize the words of the Amoraim out of their internal understanding. Does this mean that the Stamed Gemara always presents the Amoraim exactly for what they intended in Pshat? No, certainly not. But it does mean that whatever they said is Torah Kedosha, because even if it's not what the Amoraim intended, it's what their students intended, who are the Baalei HaSugya. Now what we're going to do next week is we're going to go in depth in this sugya. If you please could go over the sugya very well. It goes to the almost to the end of the next Amud. And please try to organize for yourself the Torah HaAmoraim first, and then ask yourself, what is the Stamed Gemara adding on top of the Torah HaAmoraim? And we will discuss this next week. Now, Tobias Roth from Miami says, there is a sense in which the halakha and its reasoning stands above the individuals who expound the halakha. So why was it important, except out of courtesy to the author of the halakha, to know who said what? Shouldn't we therefore emphasize the logic of the halakha? I'm really very happy that you asked that question, because I think you've put your finger on the difference between the standard yeshiva approach in our day and the approach that I'm trying to teach you, and what I believe to have been the approach of the Rishonim and the great Achronim. In standard yeshiva approach today, there is no interest who said what when. It's irrelevant. The only thing that's relevant are the conceptualizations, because halakha stands, as it were, as you're saying, above time and space. What I'm trying to explain is that halakha does not stand above time and place. Halakha moves through and in time and space. Torah was given at a certain point of time, in a certain place, to a certain individual named Moshe Rabbeinu, by Hashem. And in each and every generation, that Torah, bounded by time and space, moves into new times and new spaces, and the Chachamim, who are specific people in those times and spaces, interpret the Torah as is their right and authority in order to apply eternal values to changing circumstances. And that is what Torah Shebaal Peh is all about. When you strip Torah Shebaal Peh from its historical and personal contexts, you say it doesn't matter who is saying it, when they're saying it, and where they're saying it, then you are stripping Torah Shebaal Peh of the dynamism which is its substance. And in this sense, I recommend that you read the book Not in Heaven by Eliezer Berkowitz, because he explains these concepts in detail, especially in the chapter at the end of the book, Halakha in Exile. So I recommend that bibliography. Here's the book, Not in Heaven, by Eliezer Berkowitz, Lo B'Shamayim Hi, we will continue therefore to give context to every Amora according to his time, his place, and his circumstances. Well, okay, that's it for today. Signing off from the beautiful broadcasting studios of Torah in Motion in Midtown Toronto. We will look forward to seeing you all next week, and we bid you a Shavua Tov.
You got other questions
about it,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Kol Tov. Bye-bye.